Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. We have Brian Phillips with his book, Impossible Owls. It's a book of essays. Now, a wonderful publishing house, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, are publishing books that they fear that they won't fly. They're too original, they're too fresh, they're too funny, they're too surprising, and so they put them in a paperback book. Now, what did they think they were getting?
That's a really good question. I hope they thought they were getting what they published, because we put into the world the book that I wanted to put into the world, which, as you know, in 2018 is not something writers can take for granted going into a relationship with a publishing company.
The first essay is about a dog sled race,
yes,
in Alaska, one of the most dangerous such in the world, let alone in Alaska. The following essay is about sumo wrestling,
yes,
but it is intercut with the narration of the death of
Yukio Mishima, yes, the Japanese novelist.
The great Japanese novelist. And you see, if you were asking me, I'd have said, oh, reading the first essay, Brian Phillips is an essay writer whose expertise is in dog sled racing. And then I'd have said, Brian Phillips knows Japanese literature and the way it interacts with the rituals of sumo wrestling. But then I come across an essay too later, and it's about tigers. It's about man-eaters.
Yes.
And the revelation that tigers, I wouldn't have thought so, are nearly invisible. You don't see tigers when they first appear. Why is a tiger invisible?
Well, it makes sense when you are in the jungle trying to look at one. The pattern on the tiger's coat that seems so vivid and striking when you see it in a vacuum or against a white background or against a man-made background just disappears in this sort of atmospheric dapple of sun and shadow and moving leaf shadows and, red, orange, dead leaves on the ground, all of which kind of blend into a hole in the Indian jungle into which the tiger can very, very easily vanish. I think I write in the book in one place about being about 30 feet from a large, maybe a 400 or 500 pound tiger. And as I was looking at it, watching it kind of stereoscope in and out of view, like it would disappear
appear
as I was seeing it. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah,
it's quite stunning.
Yes. And in these 8 essays, all of them on different topics, Russian cartoon animation, small town science fiction, the behavior around royalty in England, both before and after the death of the princess. What is your specialty, and why do you know all the things you know?
Well, I know all the things I know because I start out not knowing anything, and I find when I become captivated by a topic that I want to find out everything I can until I reach a sort of uncertainty or an ambiguity beyond which I cannot know anything further, if that makes sense. I am certainly beginning these essays. I was far from an expert on any of the subjects. They were all topics that I became curious about. I have, I think, a restless imagination. I'd like to get very obsessed with, you know, one subject, go very deeply into it, and then switch to something radically different.
Now, in addition, dare I say that you're a formalist. Each of these essays has, contrary to expectation, a sudden two or three paragraph section about owls out of the blue, rarely connected to the subject of the essays. Where do the owls come from? These are impossible owls.
Yes, in some cases, literally. I'm interested in all of the subjects I'm interested in because they approach the boundary of what is knowable in some way. I mean, the royal family is a fun and gossipy subject, but the royal family also raises all sorts of questions about how geography warps into mythology, which warps into politics. I'm interested in pursuing these threads to a point beyond which I can't go. And to me, the owls are sort of just on the other side of that point, the jumping off point for the my obsession with owls. I mean, in some of the essays, they were actually already there before I thought about it consciously. But I spoke to someone, when I was working on a piece about UFOs and alien abduction, who talked to me about how owls tended to appear around paranormal events. You know, you see three owls on the telephone wire, and then when you drive around the corner, there's the alien ship that changes your life. So I found that such a riveting idea.
And in turn, you see, that essay, am I right in thinking that's from the essay called Lost Highway?
Yes, exactly.
And the Lost Highway is the once upon a time American highway of television fame, Route 66.
Yes.
Route 66 hardly exists anymore. Much of it is grass and sand. It's been replaced by interstates.
Yes.
And yet on Route 66, this becomes a skeletal, after-the-fact map of UFO sightings. And then, in turn, for the appearance of these mysterious owls.
Yes, exactly. I flew to Roswell, New Mexico for one of these pieces, and then drove from Roswell to Area 51, to the gates of Area 51. You can't actually get inside, and it's hard even to get to the gates. But
there aren't even gates.
There aren't literally gates. There are just signs in the middle of what appears to be a kind of trackless desert telling you not to go any farther. And then if you look a little ways ahead, there's a small hill. And at the top of the hill, maybe 200 yards behind the signs, at the top of the hill, there will be a white pickup truck. And no one knows exactly what the white pickup truck is doing, but
or if there's anyone in it.
It's always there, and that's Area 51.
So I'm talking to Brian Phillips about his book of essays, Impossible Owls, and what he's done is to take the fact and draw it as close to the border of narrative fiction as he can, and to draw that border of narrative fiction via acts of free association into essays that form, I don't know what to call it, like targets. They have radii in circle within circle within circle. So although, of course, Yukio Mishima was not a sumo wrestler, talking about sumo wrestlers, one is reinvoking the sense of hierarchy that creates the Mishima sensibility. And if you're like me, and I have to assume at least some of you are, there are subjects that you've given up on the possibility of knowing or understanding. So if you happen to read an essay by Brian Phillips, he's about to tell you all about the things you assumed you'd never know. You were writing many of these for the internet,
yes,
for internet magazines.
Grantland magazine,
Grantland magazine. Were they more generous to writers about changing subjects, about faces, surprise venues? Because this is wonderful writing.
These essays would have been impossible to publish in most traditional magazines, at least in traditional magazines that could have afforded to pay for them. I've been extraordinarily lucky to work for a couple of websites that had kind of major corporate funding and corporations that weren't paying attention to what we were doing with their funding, and to have had editors who gave me a great deal of freedom to go off, you know, not necessarily knowing exactly what I was doing or exactly what I was writing about, and just kind of come back with what I came back with. It's been really an extraordinary chain of good luck for me that made these essays possible.
Now, in the summer of 1977, the first sentence goes, a fire swept across the wilderness of interior Alaska, north of Denali, which was then still officially known as Mount McKinley. And this fire is part of the route on this enormously demanding race. What is the name of the race?
The race is known as the Iditarod, the Iditarod dog sled race. The name Iditarod, no one's quite sure where it comes from, but it's the name of a ghost town that was a former kind of mining camp that falls along the route of the race in certain years.
And when he decides that he's going to cover this, Brian first applies to editors and then starts getting notes from those editors saying, well, okay, but don't die.
Yeah, the only editorial direction I really had for that piece going in was please don't die, which was a line that showed up disquietingly often in my emails during that period.
And get this, before the race begins, am I right? All 60 of the participants make opening speeches on the night before, on the party before the race. This takes all night long.
There is a very, it's not the night before. It might be. I don't remember exactly. It might be a couple of nights before. But yes, there's a banquet in Anchorage where everyone who's participating in the Iditarod, the purpose of the banquet is to draw their starting positions out of this large muckluck, you know, kind of Eskimo boot. And they draw their numbers, and then everyone gives a speech in which they thank their sponsors and talk about what their hopes and dreams are for that year's race. And it really is almost as much an endurance event as the race itself.
It's a lottery. And then you join a man now dead.
Yes.
You learn in the after notes that the man who took you up in the air to follow the race died in the course of leading another group of trainees.
Yes, exactly.
But you see, as we read about this race, just why you became so close to him.
Hmm.
He had enormous patience for the fact that you had no experience whatsoever. Now, how did you dare to go on such a life-threatening pursuit?
Well, I should tell your listeners exactly what following the Iditarod entailed, maybe, which was that I had to go to Alaska before the race began to learn how to fly a small plane, and specifically how to land the plane on skis on frozen rivers and lakes, because the Iditarod runs for about 1,000 miles.
Yes, these planes have to be on snow skis to land on frozen rivers.
So the process, thankfully for me, was it was very kind of one foot and then another foot. You know, I thought I'd like to go cover the Iditarod, and I had that thought before I knew I would have to learn to fly the plane. So it was kind of by the time that I was actually up in the air trying to land an airplane on a lake, I had gone through several antechambers of increasing anxiety.
Okay, now as soon as we finish reading the essay on this Alaskan race, we turn the page. This is one of the great joys of books. We turn the page and we read about sumo wrestling.
Yes.
Had you started out being an enthusiast of Japanese literature?
Yes, I was an enthusiast of Japanese literature and film, certainly before I was interested in sumo wrestling. I had in college worked at a bookstore where one of my fellow employees gave me a copy of the novel Snow Country by Yasunari Kawabata, and I became really deeply interested in Japanese literature after that, which is a...
And here we are told by our guest, the author, writing about Snow Country, that the novel ends before you may realize
yes.
that it has completed its intention.
Yes.
And that this is a feature of Japanese writing. And we realize he's brought this feature to bear on his essay because the Mishima sections never quite but almost join
yes.
the sections on sumo wrestling.
And I never quite meet the person that I am working throughout the essay to track down. I became interested while I was in Tokyo in finding the man who had actually beheaded Mishima after Mishima, for those who don't know, committed suicide very dramatically. Yes, precisely. But he took a general hostage in the headquarters of the Japanese self-defense forces and then went out to give a speech urging the members of the what was then the Japanese army to rise up and overthrow the government and restore power to the emperor. And when they laughed at him, he went back into the general's office and killed himself. He had founded his own private right-wing army years earlier and was accompanied by several young officers in his kind of hobbyist army, one of whom was then called upon to actually decapitate him as the kind of final blow of his suicide.
Who does and disappears.
Yes.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. If I still know who I am at this point, I'm very lucky because one of the great joys of Brian Phillips' book, Impossible Owls Essays, is that it will make you forget who you are. It's a wonderful thing. Many of us like to read magazines because they introduce us to factual stories, but this is factual stories, hypotheses, surprise interpretations. I think that he brings to the essay the kinds of things that sometimes are talked about when people talk now about lyrical essays. Mm. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Brian Phillips about his book of essays, Impossible Owls, Iconoclastic Journalism from the Digital Age. I'm crazy about the final essay, too. It's called But Not Like Your Typical Love Story.
Yes.
And it's not like your typical love story because it keeps changing its nature every five or six pages. you really have figured out how to tell a story, an essay story, so that, like a fairy tale, there's a new monster or a new prince or a new treasure or reward every couple of pages. And can I confide to my listeners, I couldn't go to sleep. It's a 60-page essay. I couldn't stop before I'd read the whole thing. And I felt that way in general. Now, when did you know that you had a book?
Well, it was a strange way to go about assembling a book, I think, because my agent and editor and I joked a couple of times that I had sold a sort of selected essay collection to Farrar Straus before I had written enough essays to fill a selected essay collection. But I had kind of five long pieces that I knew made sense together as a collection that, as different as they were from one another, both thematically and topically and formally, as you said, the kind of spiral of obsessiveness or thought form underlying them or something was similar enough that they would go together. So I thought at that point that it made sense to start talking to publishers about the book. And then I had the ideas for the other essays, you know, in notebooks going back a long way, and was just kind of looking for a green light or an excuse to work on them. So
what's the longest amount of time any of these essays took to write?
It depends whether you include the research process, which sometimes
added
quite a long time. I mean, the last essay, the Not Like Your Typical Love Story, is an essay about my hometown. So you could say I've been working on that my whole life in
Your
a way.
Whole life, yes.
The essay about tigers dates back many years, 7 or 8 years, to when I first became interested in the writing of a man named Jim Corbett, who was a kind of a great white hunter figure from the early 20th century, who was known for going into really remote jungle villages. This was, you know, during the British occupation of India. British imperial land clearing practices had created a crisis for rural villagers in India, where man-eating tigers were just killing hundreds of people. They were tigers who'd been driven out of their natural habitat by the destruction of forests. No one knew that's what was causing it at the time.
Yes, but, well, you take an animal away from its natural diet, and they're going to find something to eat.
Precisely.
And if that something is you, and you are the one who's robbed it of its natural diet, this is the story in small of what we've done to our environment,
yes,
and our animals ever since.
Unfortunately, it was even worse in this case, because it was the British who had created the man-eaters, but it was the Indian villagers who were being killed by them. So Corbett became this kind of beloved figure in rural northern India, because he would go into the forest by himself with a rifle and track down the most dangerous man-eaters and shoot them. And he killed tigers that were responsible for hundreds of deaths, and that no one else had successfully tracked down. And then he wrote books about them much later in life, in the 1930s and 40s. Actually, I think maybe beginning in the 40s. I became really fascinated by this figure because he seemed to me to be a genuinely heroic person who was also the emblem of an absolutely poisonous and destructive empire. You know, it was Corbett's kind of paternalistic sense that he needed to protect the Indian villagers. It was kind of almost like chivalry that led him to go risk his life to kill these tigers. This just seemed to me a fascinating, not a kind of thorny, twisty story. But I could never write it without going to India and seeing tigers in the wild, and I could never find an editor who would sign off on the insurance for that. So that essay was something that I turned over and over for 7 or 8 years before I was able to finally do it.
You know, for quite a few years, I would read the poet Randall Jarrell's essays on Rudyard Kipling, and his essays on Rudyard Kipling precede the days when Kipling becomes abhorrent for talking about shouldering the white man's burden.
Yes.
Jarrell is not wrong. Kipling is a magnificent writer. That book, Kim, is a wonderful book about childhood. It's really beautiful. And yet it is quite true that you would have to really justify asking people to read it now.
Yes.
So too in this essay, you're trying to find a way to write about a man who is killing man-eating tigers heroically. A tiger is invisible for a reason. He's stalking us, and we are stalking him, and the stalking condition is the relationship, pardon me, between the writer of an essay and its reader. And so what I found in your book was that you were telling me things I wanted to know, that I was afraid to know, that I, in some sense, had to know to be reminded of the reality of the world in which we all live. And so the book was meaningful and moving. In addition to factual, it was whimsical, witness these owls that come in and out of essays unpredictably. It was whimsical in addition to encyclopedic. It brought so many qualities to the essay and the essay form. And so I want to recommend it highly to my listeners who usually hear me talking about one novel, book of poetry, or short stories. You can read Impossible Owls, essays by Brian Phillips, with the pleasure with which you'd read a really great work of fiction or poetry. And I thank you for coming here to talk to us about them.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's such a pleasure for me to be here.
I've been talking with Brian Phillips, author of Impossible Owls, published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux Originals. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show if you missed it when it aired. Also available on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And you can listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. Our guest engineer today is Philip Richards. Our technical director usually is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Edward St. Aubin is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.